page 149. Starting chapter 22, Christmas festivities. Christmas was approaching. Grandmother brought me materials, and I busied myself making some new garments and little playthings for my children. Were it not that hiring day is near at hand, and many families are fearfully looking forward to the probability of separation in a few days, Christmas might be a happy season for the poor slaves. Even slave mothers tried to gladden the hearts of their little ones on the occasion. Betty and Ellen had their Christmas stockings filled. Their imprisoned mother could not have the privilege of witnessing their surprise and joy, but I had the pleasure of peeping at them as they went into the street with their new suits on. I heard Benny ask a little playmate whether Santa Claus brought him anything. "Yes," replied the boy, "but Santa Claus ain't a real man. It's the children's mothers that put things into the stockings." "No, that can't be," replied Benny, "for Santa Claus brought Ellen and me these new clothes, and my mother has been gone this long time." How I longed to tell him that his mother made those garments and that many a tear fell on them while she worked. Every child rises early on Christmas morning to see the John Canouse. Without them, Christmas would be shorn of its greatest attraction. They consist of companies of slaves from the plantations, generally of the lower class. Two athletic men in calico wrappers have a net thrown over them covered with all manner of bright-colored stripes. Cows' tails are fastened to their backs, and their heads are decorated with horns. A box covered with sheepskin is called the gumbo box. A dozen beat on this, while others strike triangles and jawbones to which bands of dancers keep time. Page 150. For a month previous, they are composing songs which are sung on this occasion. These companies of 100 each turn out early in the morning and are allowed to go round till 12 o'clock begging for contributions. Not a door is left unvisited where there is the least chance of obtaining a penny or a glass of rum. They do not drink while they are out, but carry the rum home in jugs to have a carousal. These Christmas donations frequently amount to $20 or $30. It is seldom that any white man or child refuses to give them a trifle. If he does, they regale his ears with the following song. "Poor massa, so dey say, down in de hill, so dey say, got no money, so dey say, not one shillin', so dey say, God a'mighty bless you, so dey say." Christmas is a day of feasting, both with white and colored people. Slaves who are lucky enough to have a few shillings are sure to spend them for good eating, and many a turkey and pig is captured without saying, "By your leave, sir." Those who cannot obtain these cook a possum or a raccoon, from which savory dishes can be made. My grandmother raised poultry and pigs for sale, and it was her established custom to have both a turkey and a pig roasted for Christmas dinner. On this occasion, I was warned to keep extremely quiet because two guests had been invited. One was the town constable, and the other was a free colored man who tried to pass himself off for white, and who was always ready to do any mean work for the sake of currying favor with white people. My grandmother had a motive for inviting them. She managed to take them all over the house. All the rooms on the lower floor were thrown open for them to pass in and out, and after dinner they were invited upstairs to look at a fine mockingbird my uncle had just brought home. There, too, the rooms were all thrown open that they might look in. Page 151. When I heard them talking on the piazza, my heart almost stood still. I knew this colored man had spent many nights hunting for me. Everybody knew he had the blood of his slave father in his veins, but for the sake of passing himself off for white, he was ready to kiss the slaveholder's feet. How I despised him! As for the constable, he wore no false colors. The duties of his office were despicable, but he was superior to his companion, inasmuch as he did not pretend to be what he was not. Any white man who could raise money enough to buy a slave would have considered himself degraded by being a constable, but the office enabled its possessor to exercise authority. If he found any slave out after 9 o'clock, he could whip him as much as he liked, and that was a privilege to be coveted. When the guests were ready to depart, my grandmother gave each of them some of her nice pudding as a present for their wives. Through my peephole I saw them go out of the gate, and I was glad when it closed after them. So passed the first Christmas in my den. Page 152 is blank. Page 153. Starting chapter 23. Still in prison. When spring returned, and I took in the little patch of green the aperture commanded, I asked myself how many more summers and winters I must be condemned to spend thus. I longed to draw in a plentiful draught of fresh air, to stretch my cramped limbs, to have room to stand erect, to feel the earth under my feet again. My relatives were constantly on the lookout for a chance of escape, but none offered that seemed practicable and even tolerably safe. The hot summer came again and made the turpentine drop from the thin roof over my head. During the long nights I was restless for want of air, and I had no room to toss and turn. There was but one compensation. The atmosphere was so stifled that even mosquitoes would not condescend to buzz in it. With all my detestation of Dr. Flint, I could hardly wish him a worse punishment, either in this world or that which is to come, than to suffer what I suffered in one single summer. Yet the laws allowed him to be out in the free air, while I, guiltless of crime, was pent up here, as the only means of avoiding the cruelties the laws allowed him to inflict upon me. I don't know what kept life within me. Again and again I thought I should die before long, but I saw the leaves of another autumn whirl through the air, and felt the touch of another winter. In summer the most terrible thunderstorms were acceptable, for the rain came through the roof, and I rolled up my bed that it might cool the hot boards under it. Later in the season, storms sometimes wet my clothes through and through, but that was not comfortable when the air grew chilly. Moderate storms I could keep out by filling the chinks with oakum. Page 154. But uncomfortable as my situation was, I had glimpses of things out of doors, which made me thankful for my wretched hiding place. One day I saw a slave pass our gate, muttering, "It's his own, and he can kill it if he will." My grandmother told me that woman's history. Her mistress had that day seen her baby for the first time, and in the lineaments of its fair face she saw a likeness to her husband. She turned the bondwoman and her child out of doors and forbade her ever to return. The slave went to her master and told him what had happened. He promised to talk with her mistress and make it all right. The next day she and her baby were sold to a Georgia trader. Another time I saw a woman rush wildly by, pursued by two men. She was a slave, the wet nurse of her mistress's children. For some trifling offense, her mistress ordered her to be stripped and whipped. To escape the degradation of the torture, she rushed to the river, jumped in, and ended her wrongs in death. Senator Brown of Mississippi could not be ignorant of many such facts as these, for they are of frequent occurrence in every southern state. Yet he stood up in the Congress of the United States and declared that slavery was a great moral, social, and political blessing, a blessing to the master and a blessing to the slave. I suffered much more during the second winter than I did during the first. My limbs were benumbed by inaction, and the cold filled them with cramp. I had a very painful sensation of coldness in my head. Even my face and tongue stiffened, and I lost the power of speech. Of course it was impossible, under the circumstances, to summon any physician. My brother William came and did all he could for me. Uncle Philip also watched tenderly over me, and poor grandmother crept up and down to inquire whether there were any signs of returning life. I was restored to consciousness by the dashing of cold water in my face, and found myself leaning against my brother's arm while he bent over me with streaming eyes. He afterwards told me he thought I was dying, for I had been in an unconscious state 16 hours. I next became delirious, and was in great danger of betraying myself and my friends. To prevent this, they stupefied me with drugs. Page 155. I remained in bed 6 weeks, weary in body and sick at heart. How to get medical advice was the question. William finally went to a Thompsonian doctor and described himself as having all my pains and aches. He returned with herbs, roots, and ointment. He was especially charged to rub on the ointment by a fire, but how could a fire be made in my little den? Charcoal in a furnace was tried, but there was no outlet for the gas, and it nearly cost me my life. Afterwards, coals, already kindled, were brought up in an iron pan and placed on bricks. I was so weak, and it was so long since I had enjoyed the warmth of a fire, that those few coals actually made me weep. I think the medicines did me some good, but my recovery was very slow. Dark thoughts passed through my mind as I lay there day after day. I tried to be thankful for my little cell, dismal as it was, and even to love it, as part of the price I had paid for the redemption of my children. Sometimes I thought God was a compassionate Father who would forgive my sins for the sake of my sufferings. At other times it seemed to me there was no justice or mercy in the divine government. I asked why the curse of slavery was permitted to exist, and why I had been so persecuted and wronged from youth upward. These things took the shape of mystery, which is to this day not so clear to my soul as I trust it will be hereafter. In the midst of my illness, Grandmother broke down under the weight of anxiety and toil. The idea of losing her, who had always been my best friend and a mother to my children, was the sorest trial I had yet had. Oh, how earnestly I prayed that she might recover! How hard it seemed that I could not tend upon her who had so long and so tenderly watched over me. One day the screams of a child nerved me with strength to crawl to my peeping-hole, and I saw my son covered with blood. A fierce dog, usually kept chained, had seized and bitten him. A doctor was sent for, and I heard the groans and screams of my child while the wounds were being sewed up. Oh, what torture to a mother's heart to listen to this and be unable to go to him! But childhood is like a day in spring, alternately shower and sunshine. Page 156. Before night, Benny was bright and lively, threatening the destruction of the dog, and great was his delight when the doctor told him the next day that the dog had bitten another boy and been shot. Benny recovered from his wounds, but it was long before he could walk. When my grandmother's illness became known, many ladies who were her customers called to bring her some little comforts and to inquire whether she had everything she wanted. Aunt Nancy one night asked permission to watch with her sick mother, and Mrs. Flint replied, "I don't see any need of your going. I can't spare you." But when she found other ladies in the neighborhood were so attentive, not wishing to be outdone in Christian charity, she also sallied forth in magnificent condescension and stood by the bedside of her who had loved her in her infancy and who had been repaid by such grievous wrongs. She seemed surprised to find her so ill, and scolded Uncle Philip for not sending for Dr. Flint. She herself sent for him immediately, and he came. Secure as I was in my retreat, I should have been terrified if I had known he was so near me. He pronounced my grandmother in a very critical situation, and said if her attending physician wished it, he would visit her. Nobody wished to have him coming to the house at all hours, and we were not disposed to give him a chance to make out a long bill. As Mrs. Flint went out, Sally told her the reason Benny was lame was that a dog had bitten him. "I'm glad of it," replied she. "I wish he had killed him. It would be good news to send to his mother. Her day will come. The dogs will grab her yet." With these Christian words, she and her husband departed, and to my great satisfaction returned no more. I heard from Uncle Philip with feelings of unspeakable joy and gratitude that the crisis was past and Grandmother would live. I could now say from my heart, God is merciful. He has spared me the anguish of feeling that I caused her death. Page 157. Starting Chapter 24. The Candidate for Congress. The summer had nearly ended when Dr. Flint made a third visit to New York in search of me. Two candidates were running for Congress, and he returned in season to vote. The father of my children was the Whig candidate. The doctor had hitherto been a staunch Whig, but now he exerted all his energies for the defeat of Mr. Sands. He invited large parties of men to dine in the shade of his trees, and supplied them with plenty of rum and brandy. If any poor fellow drowned his wits in the bowl, and in the openness of his convivial heart proclaimed that he did not mean to vote the Democratic ticket, he was shoved into the street without ceremony. The doctor expended his liquor in vain. Mr. Sands was elected, an event which occasioned me some anxious thoughts. He had not emancipated my children, and if he should die they would be at the mercy of his heirs. Two little voices that frequently met my ears seemed to plead with me not to let their father depart without striving to make their freedom secure. Years had passed since I had spoken to him. I had not even seen him since the night I passed him unrecognized in my disguise of a sailor. I supposed he would call before he left to say something to my grandmother concerning the children, and I resolved what course to take. The day before his departure for Washington, I made arrangements toward evening to get from my hiding-place into the storeroom below. I found myself so stiff and clumsy that it was with great difficulty I could hitch from one resting-place to another. When I reached the storeroom, my ankles gave way under me, and I sank exhausted on the floor. Page 158. It seemed as if I could never use my limbs again, but the purpose I had in view roused all the strength I had. I crawled on my hands and knees to the window, and, screened behind a barrel, I waited for his coming. The clock struck 9, and I knew the steamboat would leave between 10 and 11. My hopes were failing, but presently I heard his voice saying to someone, Wait for me a moment. I wish to